You're listening to part two of episode 620 of Unwelcome Guests. I don't want to go to Toronto.
I don't want to go. I don't want to go to Toronto. I don't want to go. All of the blocks are square. None of the streets are twisted. None of the streets are paved with bricks. There's too many elevators in Toronto. Not enough stairs in Toronto. Not enough stairs. All of the food in Toronto is made of edible oil products. They don't have bagels in Toronto. They have donuts. Donuts made of edible oil. I don't like donuts. They don't have bagels. I don't want to go to Toronto. People don't have faces in Toronto. They have cigarette ads instead. They listen to your phone calls. There's a tower in Toronto that controls people's minds. It's illegal to possess brightly colored balloons in Toronto. Illegal to own brightly colored balloons. All of the children in Toronto must wear suits. Even the girls, three-piece suits. The buildings in Toronto have no windows. I don't want to go. Everyone lives in subterranean caverns filled with donuts made of edible oil. I don't want to go. Nobody goes to the bathroom in Toronto. They have a special operation. They have it removed surgically. There's a tax on all wicker goods in Toronto. There's huge buildings with no windows on streets with no curves. And inside you find little girls in suits running around with black balloons and munching on edible oil products. The kids don't have names. They have numbers which are assigned to them at birth. They're called 387.7, 412.9, and they all have cigarette ads instead of faces. I don't want to go to Toronto. I don't want to go. I have plenty of wicker goods. I don't want a tax on my wicker goods. I like going to the bathroom. I don't want to go to the hospital. I don't want to go to Toronto. I don't want to go. Do I have to go to Toronto?
And that was I Don't Want to Go to Toronto by Radio Free Vestibule. We continue with the speech by Robert Whittaker.
And you can read, U.S. Surgeon General David Satcher in 1998 produced a long report on mental health. And here's what he said. He said that prior to 1955, prior to Thorazine, we lacked treatments to prevent people from becoming chronically ill. Then we got this vast array of safe and effective treatments, and now we can prevent this chronicity in most people. Okay? That's the story of medical progress. And by the way, in the past 20 years since the arrival of SSRIs, we have embraced this in a big way. So, for example, in 1987, our country spent about $800 million on psychiatric medications. In 2007, it was $40 billion. So there is this extraordinary increase. And also, if you look at the expansion of the market, something like, or the use of these drugs, something like 10% of all children, 0 to 18, now take a psychiatric drug in the United States. So that is quite a societal embrace of this form of care. In adults, I can't quite figure out what the percentage of adults is, but I think it's at least 15% today. So we really have embraced this paradigm of care. Okay, so what I did as a starting point, just to question this, is it really, have we had this great advance? Is this paradigm of care really working for us? The first thing I did is just look at disability rates in our society due to mental illness. And by disability rates, people who in one way or another are under government care, okay? And the way that other people have tracked this metric from 1955 forward, and there can be a problem in a small way, but let's just do what they have done. In 1955, they say those under government care, because they were, quote, disabled by mental illness, were in state and mental hospitals, okay? And so in 1955, there were 560,000 people in state and county mental hospitals. But you need to dig into those numbers a bit, because it turns out at that time, there were a number of people there that really weren't there for what conditions we would say were our psychiatric conditions. There were people there with end-stage syphilis, Alzheimer's disease. They served as nursing homes in many cases. So there were really 360,000 people with a psychiatric diagnosis in those hospitals at that time. Now you take the population, and that's a disability rate of 1 in 480 people, roughly. So that's our baseline rate as this revolution unfolds, okay? Now, after that, we do decide as a society to try to deinstitutionalize our mental hospitals, and we say we're going to care for those with serious mental illness in the community, right? And so what happens is we set up basically a disability system, SSI and SSDI. These are federal government programs where if you are disabled for whatever reason, you can get this federal support, okay? And what other researchers have done and said, if you want to track the number of disabled mentally ill in our society, you have to then look at the SSI and SSDI numbers, okay, going forward in modern times. Now, there can be a little bit of a problem with this. It may be that it's a little bit of an apples to oranges comparison, but nevertheless, let's go forward with it. So in 1987, and this is the moment Prozac arrives in the market, there were 1.25 million people on SSI or SSDI because of a mental illness. That's why they were declared eligible. And that's a disability rate of around 1 in 184. Okay, so we went from 1 in 480 to 1 in 100 and roughly 84. Now, there may be some problems, like I said, in comparing that metric, but now let's just compare from 1987 to 2007. Our spending on psychiatric medications rose from $800 million to $40 billion in that time. The number of people on disability from 1987 to 2007 tripled. It went from 1.25 million to 4 million adults. And I don't know how many, so you can see a beginning of a question arising. Why are we seeing this rise in the number of people on disability? And that disability rate in 2007 is down to about 1 in 75. So you see, excuse me, as this revolution has unfolded, we are seeing a rising disability rate. So at the very least, it raises a question, I think. And how many people do you think we have here? I don't know, 400 people. The number of people going on disability every day in the United States, adults, due to mental illness, is 850 people per day, 365 days a year. So imagine two auditoriums this full, that's how many people are going on to disability. And that's why I call it the epidemic. It's at the very least, it shows you that we need to pay attention to this and ask questions about what's going on. Now, how about children, just for a second? In children in 1987, there were 16,200 children who received an SSI payment because they were disabled, you know, they were considered seriously ill due to a mental illness. 16,200. Today, it's 600,000. So this is 35-fold increase. The number of children going on to disability now every day in the United States due to mental illness is 250 children per day. That's the scope of this sort of epidemic we need to talk about. And if you follow those children forward to age 18, they are going right on to lifetime, long-term disability, many of them. And it's like this pathway has opened up in our society where kids do get diagnosed, they get treated, and next thing you know, they sort of have this career as a mental patient stretching out before them. And just so you know, in terms of societal cost, I did some back-of-the-envelope calculations, like that child that goes on at age 18, that youth, what's it going to cost to support that person? What's going to be well over $1 million? So you can just see as from a societal sort of point of view, the burden of mental illness has not decreased in our society as the psychopharmacological revolution has unfolded. For whatever reason, it is increasing at a rapid rate. In terms of spending on mental health services, in 2001, it was we spent about $85 billion on mental health services in this country. In 2007, we spent $170 billion. So we doubled it in 7 years. And now if the federal government had a report recently, if you look at medical expenditures, spending on mental health services, there's the fastest growing concern. So I think you're beginning to see the scope of the puzzle and why we do need to address this. And here's how I set up the puzzle in the book, and I really want to echo what Bill said. Do we know that medications help many people in times of acute distress? Yes, we do. Do we all know people who are on medications and doing well? Yes, we do. But nevertheless, so we know that the medications can help. But nevertheless, we have this disability, rising disability at the time of rising use of medications. And so, having set that puzzle up in the book, I'm asking these questions. I really want to address. First of all, do these drugs fix chemical imbalances in the brain? Is that true? Is that belief system we have, is it an accurate one? Because also that becomes the rationale for long-term consistent use, because they're like insulin for diabetes. We want to know if that's true. The second thing that this book does, and I really think it's the first effort to really do it, is try to look at how did the medication shape long-term outcomes in the aggregates? In other words, are we improving the course of schizophrenia in the aggregates? Are we doing that for anxiety? Are we doing that for depression? And are we doing it for manic depressive illness? And again, the thing is you want to look sort of the collection of outcomes, okay? And hopefully what we're going to see is that we are, but this is a question that really hasn't been addressed before. And I can talk a little bit about how I do it, but that's really the heart of the book, to really try to bring that information forward. And then the final question I'm really asking in this book is this. Is it possible that you can take people who have a milder problem, say a mild bout of depression, and they get treated with an antidepressant? Will there be a certain percentage of people that maybe have an adverse reaction to that or a bad reaction to the antidepressant? Say they might have a manic episode or even a psychotic episode or whatever. And once that happens, do they get pushed into the bipolar category, which is a much more serious diagnosis? And the reason you need to ask this question and why you want to ask this question is this. Manic depressive, bipolar illness used to be called manic depressive illness. It used to be fairly rare. So if you look at prevalence numbers for manic depressive illness in, say, 1950s, it was about 1 in 5,000 people, adults. Today it's 1 in 50. So there's a 100-fold increase, roughly, in the prevalence of bipolar illness. So if we really want to figure out this epidemic, we have to figure out where are all the bipolar patients coming from. So those are the three questions in the book. And I'll just, obviously I don't have time to go through it in great detail, but I'll sort of hit some highlights and then I'll get off the stage as fast as possible because there are some panel members that I am really eager to hear here. Quickly, the chemical imbalance story. Where did that arise? The chemical imbalance theory of mental disorders arose actually in the 1960s, and it arose from an understanding of how medications act on the brain. It did not arise from investigations of people so diagnosed. It arose from understanding in a very specific way, first of all, how antipsychotics affect the brain. So we had Thorazine and Haldol, and I'll explain this in a second a bit more. But what they learned was that those drugs block dopamine transmission in the brain. Dopamine is a neurotransmitter, right? So they learned that they blocked it, thwarted it, decreased that transmission. So then they hypothesized that people with schizophrenia had too much dopamine in the brain, okay? But the hypothesis arose basically to explain why the drugs might work, not because of what they found in people with schizophrenia, okay? And then let's just go ahead a little bit with depression. So you've heard the story about that people with depression have low serotonin, right? We've all heard that. That arose from understanding how antidepressants act on the brain, all right? And then they hypothesized the opposite. So real quickly, since we've all heard about, I'll do the story with serotonin, with antidepressants, since we've all heard the story. So Prozac is known as a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor, right? So here's how Prozac works. You have a presynaptic neuron. Neurons have to communicate in the brain, right? So a presynaptic neuron will release serotonin into a small gap called a synaptic cleft between that and a postsynaptic neuron. And this is a way to communicate a message from the presynaptic neuron to the postsynaptic neuron. That serotonin enters the synaptic cleft, and it binds with receptors on this postsynaptic neuron, okay? Now, that message has to be, it needs to be short and quick. So the brain has to remove that serotonin from the synaptic cleft really fast to end the message. Now, the way it removes the serotonin, it does it in one of two ways. It either has an enzyme that comes along and metabolizes the serotonin and carts it off as waste, as metabolites, or it is taken back up into the presynaptic neuron via reuptake channels. So what Prozac does, and the SSRIs, it blocks the reuptake channels. All right? So that keeps that serotonin longer in the synaptic cleft. And that's why they say it raises serotonin levels or raises that activity. So what people hypothesized, and this actually goes back before Prozac ever came to the market, was people with depression have low serotonin. I'm not going to go into the science of how they did that, but they began investigating that in 1970s, and they did not find that to be so. They did not find that people with depression had characteristically low amounts of serotonin. And as early as 1984, the NIMH concluded on an early investigation of the sort of serotonergic theory of depression, elevations, this is in 1984, elevations or decrements in the functioning of serotonergic systems per se are not likely to be associated with depression. So they weren't finding low amounts. Long story, just to keep that going forward, Prozac comes to market. There was a lot of other investigations into serotonin. They just never found that as a matter of routine that people with depression had low serotonin. So, for example, you can read Stephen Stahl. He's a molecular psychopharmacologist. He wrote a book called Essential Psychopharmacology in 2000, and he concludes, sums up this whole thing. There is no clear and convincing evidence that monoamine deficiency, serotonin is a monoamine, monoamine deficiency accounts for depression. That is, there is no real monoamine deficit. Okay, that's what he concluded in 2000. By the way, if you can do the same thing for this overactive dopamine system theory of schizophrenia, do they, as a matter of course, have overactive dopamine systems? They did not find that to be so. There may be some dopaminergic involvement in bursts when you have a psychotic episode, but as a customary thing, they did not find that to be so. So, for example, Stephen Hyman, he was the director of the NIMH in the 90s. He's a neuroscientist. He says in a 2002 book, there is no compelling evidence that a lesion in the dopamine system is a primary cause of schizophrenia. Finally, in 2005, Kenneth Kendler, co-editor-in-chief of Psychological Medicine, writes this, of this whole long search for chemical imbalances. He says, we have hunted for big, simple neurochemical explanations for psychiatric disorders, and we have not found them. Now, what are the ramifications of this? The ramifications of this are, there's many, but one of the ramifications is, first of all, good medicine and a good societal sort of use of medications requires an honest understanding of what's going on. And there was just a paper out that surveyed Americans about their understanding of mental disorders, and 80% of Americans now know that depression is due to a chemical imbalance. 87% of Americans now know that schizophrenia is due to a chemical imbalance. Now, that is not a story of a society that has come to understand mental disorders. That is a story of a society that has become deluded about mental disorders. There's a couple other ramifications. I'm not saying that there might not be biological involvement. I actually think there is biological involvement many times with psychiatric problems. We just don't know what it is. Okay? That's the second thing. But the second thing is this. We have this belief system, you have to necessarily stay on medications for life because they're like insulin for diabetes, right? That becomes the rationale for long-term use. But that's a false rationale. These drugs are not like insulin for diabetes because they're not fixing any known problem. The next ramification is really a note of optimism. If people don't necessarily have a chemical imbalance, it may be that someone can have a bout of depression, get better, and just get on with it. It may be true with psychosis. You may have environmental stresses. You may stop sleeping. You may have a bout of psychosis. With the proper care, you may be able to recover. And maybe you need medications for sometimes. But it's not even that you're going to be in recovery from a mental illness. You can just be recovered in sometimes, okay? Because that's the possibility of hope that you see in this, okay? Anyway, this is part of the discussion I think we need to have. We need to think honestly about what we know about mental disorders. And unfortunately, the brain being this extraordinarily complex place, it just has not given up its mystery, so to speak, in terms of really what are, quote, biological pathways for these different disorders. So I actually think this is a note of optimism that opens up a lot of different possibilities of care and recovery, et cetera. One other thing. We like to think that the chemical imbalance story is, it helps reduce stigma, right? That's what we say. Well, you will find actually that as this understanding has happened, stigma is increasing. So they did a survey recently about people, would you live next door to someone with a psychiatric disorder? And increasingly people say no, especially if it's with schizophrenia. So it's actually increasing some sense of fear of people as opposed to reducing it. Whereas I think if we have this sense of, we really do not know what's going on with psychiatric disorders, we don't know that people have broken brains, and that's a false thing to sort of say, it brings a different sense. It really brings a sense of brethrenship, sort of the sense of who knows. People can descend into these states and have these difficulties, and they can suffer psychiatric distress, but so can all of us, perhaps, given the right, you know, the wrong stresses, the difficult stresses, etc. I actually think this notion increases the sense of a commonness, and really brings a sense that we are brethren, and we really want to have that sense of, not instead of it's not us over here that are, quote, not mentally ill, and over here are the mentally ill, it destroys that. And then we just see it's a sort of spectrum of possibilities, so to speak. Okay, real quickly, and then I got to get off the stage. So what do I do in this book? I look at long-term outcomes for schizophrenia, anxiety, depression, and bipolar disorder, and then I look what's happening with kids as well. Is the medicating of kids, is that going well long-term for those kids? Real quickly, let's go with schizophrenia real quickly. Why do we know? We believe as a society that you have to stay on these medications for life, and we even have a system of care designed to make sure that happens. What is the evidence base that supports the use of antipsychotics? It's of two types. You'll run short-term trials. So let's say you have people coming into an emergency room with psychotic symptoms. If you run trials where you treat one with drug, one with placebo, the drug-treated group will be doing better after 6 weeks. Okay, on the target symptoms of psychosis, and that's a pretty robust evidence for short-term use of antipsychotics. Now, once those studies were done in the 60s and 70s, they asked this question, how long should people be on the medications? And they would run studies like this. They would take people that stabilized well on the medications. One group would be maintained on the drugs. The other group would be withdrawn, usually abruptly so. And those abruptly withdrawn would relapse at a higher rate, meaning the symptoms would return, as opposed to those maintained on the medications. So researchers said, aha, you take the drug away, people relapse. That shows that the drug prevents the return of symptoms. They prevent relapse. But the problem, and that's the evidence base for maintaining people on medications long term. But that doesn't tell you a couple things. First of all, you got the problem that maybe the high relapse rate is due to the withdrawal, okay, and the speed of withdrawal. And second of all, it's not telling you, is that helping people go to work? And is it really changing the long-term course of, quote, schizophrenia or psychotic disorders? It tells you nothing about functioning. And in 2002, a guy named Emmanuel Stipp, who is a psychiatrist at the University of Montreal, he looked at the long-term literature for antipsychotics and he said this, do we really know after 50 years that these are effective over the long term? And he says, really, there is no compelling evidence on the matter. And if we really want to take a closer look at this, we bear the risk of seeing some real surprises. So that's what he said in 2002. And that set me off on, can I figure out how are these medications shaping the long-term course? Real quickly on this, one of the first surprises you find, so the first thing I did is, if you go back with first episode schizophrenia patients from 1945 to 1955, what were their outcomes? This is before we had Thorazine. And you start to see something pretty optimistic. 70% would be discharged within 12 to 15 months. And at the end of 3-5 years, 70% or so would be living in the community, and they weren't on disability because we didn't have those things, those systems. So we have this sense that schizophrenia back then, nobody got better. That's not true. Many, many people got better. And the employment rates for those first episode patients from 1945 to 55, higher than 50%. So that actually is a moment of some hope, right? I'm going to bounce really quickly through the research literature on this. The first long-term study was done in the of any sort was a one-year study done by the NIMH in the early 1960s, and it had four arms. Three groups were treated with drug. The fourth arm was treated with placebo. Now, after 6 weeks, the drug-treated groups were doing better. After 1 year, they did notice something odd. They noticed that, for whatever reason, those treated with drug as a group in the hospital had a higher rehospitalization rate. There's a little bit of a sense here that maybe you're even predisposing people to greater chronicity. But the most important thing is this, is what was the employment rate in that early time of the year? 58% were employed after 1 year in that large group of patients, and 54% were self-supporting. Two-thirds of the women were functioning okay in the role of a domestic role. This is the 1960s, okay? This is a high level of function. I just want you to read what the NIMH researchers concluded at the end of 1 year. And this is not necessarily medicated patients or unmedicated patients. This is for the group as a whole. Some are off meds, some are on. The ex-hospitalized schizophrenic is more likely to be employed than not after 1 year, and if employed, is more likely to be working at a level equal to his best before hospitalization and getting on with his coworkers. So what do we see at this early moment? I'm just trying to instill this possibility, some sort of robust recovery, right? We're seeing that in the literature. Two other studies I'm going to talk about with schizophrenia, and then we'll move on real quickly to a couple others. In 1978 to 1981, a gentleman named Martin Harrell, he's a psychologist at the University of Illinois, began following a large group of patients diagnosed either with schizophrenia or, 1 minute left, psychosis, okay, or other psychotic disorders. And he just followed them up at 2 years, 4.5, 7.5, 10, and 15, okay? And then he saw, were they in, I'm going to take 3 minutes. And he was going to say, are they in recovery? Are they working? And are they taking medications? And here was his outcomes. At the end of 2 years, let's say in the schizophrenia group, those off medication were doing a little bit better than those on medication. At the end of 4.5 years, the off medication group between year 2 and year 4.5 continued to get better, such that at the end of 4.5 years, 40% of those off medication were in recovery versus 5% of those on medication. And that difference stayed the same throughout the 15 years. So there was a much higher recovery rate for those off meds. There can be many reasons for that, but at least you can see in that possibility that some people diagnosed with schizophrenia can get better and just do well. And over half of those off meds were working. In terms of the other psychotic disorders group, same sort of thing. And on the whole, it was that group that did much better long term. That's one thing you find. The second thing you find is that of those who got off, in the aggregate, they had really good outcomes. They were sort of in a recovered category, high employment rates, sort of lower rates of people suffering with symptoms. So what I'm telling you in that literature, and this is part of the discussion we need to have, is this idea that all people need to be on medications all their life, it's not reflected in the literature. And maybe what you need is a paradigm of care that uses medications in a more selective fashion. And the beauty of this is there's some people that clearly can really do well, get off, and just get on with their lives, whether it be milder psychotic disorders or, schizophrenia. Last thing, and then I am going to get off. There's a group in Finland in 1992 in Western Lapland that began using medications with their first episode psychotic patients in a different way. They began delaying initial use of antipsychotics, and the thought was, if we throw a lot of resources at people at that first break, can we help them get back on their feet without medicating them with antipsychotics? And they would use sleeping aids. They might use benzodiazepines to help people go to sleep. And they found that often they could. And they began using antipsychotic medications in a selective manner. They delayed initial use. If persons didn't start getting better, then they would use the medications for a period of time. And then those who were exposed, they would have a further sense who could go off successfully and who needed to stay on the medications. It's sort of a selective best use model. And here are their results at the end of 5 years. They now have by far the best reported results you'll see in the Western world. 80% of their first episode psychotic patients are either working or back in school at the end of 5 years. Only 20% have gone on to long-term disability. In terms of antipsychotic medication use, about one-third have been exposed to antipsychotic medication during that five-year period, and about 20% are regularly maintained on the drugs. So what's the point of this story? The point of this story is that, and this conference is being called a medication optimization conference, is maybe if we have this conversation, we can learn to use these medications in a more selective, cautious, thoughtful manner, and figure out for whom and for when and for how long, and then we can block this disability rates, we can stop this epidemic, and we can really start having systems of care that promote robust long-term recovery. And that's the hope here.
And to conclude the show, we're going to hear the start of an interview of Gail Hornstein. This is courtesy of Madness Radio from earlier this year.
This is your host, Will Hall. Today, our guest is Professor Gail Hornstein. Gail is professor of psychology at Mount Holyoke College. She's the author of two books. Her previous book is To Redeem One Person is to Redeem the World, The Life of Frieda Fromm Rykman. And her new book is Agnes's Jacket, A Psychologist's Search for the Meanings of Madness. Gail is a co-facilitator of the Hearing Voices Group that is co-sponsored by the Recovery Learning Community and the Freedom Center in Holyoke, Massachusetts. And she is a longtime ally and collaborator with the psychiatric survivor movement. Gail, it's a pleasure to have you today on Madness Radio.
Will, it's so great to be here.
Congratulations on your new book, Agnes's Jacket. It's a fantastic accomplishment that looks at some of the undercurrents of what's happening in approaches to madness and what gets called psychosis, both in the United States and in Europe. And we were really honored to have you as an active participant for years at the Freedom Center support group. And the Freedom Center is actually one of the featured subjects of Agnes's Jacket. So it's really great to have you on the show. People should also check out your book, To Redeem One Person is to Redeem the World, which is the biography of very much a maverick psychotherapist, Frieda Fromm Rykman, who had a very, very humane and compassionate approach to psychosis and madness and helping people in distress. How did you get started with your interest in this kind of alternative approach, Gail?
I think most people who study from an academic perspective or from a historical perspective, as I initially did, any aspect of psychiatry or psychoanalysis or psychology, start with the work of professionals, and they focus on professionals. And although it is true that I wrote a book about a psychiatrist, that first book about Frieda Fromm Rykman, my longest-term interest has been in accounts of madness written by people who have firsthand experience. And in the first chapter of Agnes's Jacket, the new book, I trace some of this history, and I talk about how I had been fascinated since I was a teenager with the books that people wrote about their own experiences of madness. I discovered these books in libraries when I was a teenager, and I started searching for them. And even though nobody else I knew read books like this, and most other young women I knew were reading the classics and Jane Eyre and books like that, I was reading books by people who'd been mental patients. And I found them absolutely fascinating because of the honesty and the vividness and the complexity with which people describe their experiences that were so unusual and often so agonizing. And I was so impressed by the clarity and the insight of these books. And I collected them for years. And this was kind of a private activity that I did. And when I went to graduate school in psychology, and I was studying for my PhD, I discovered, somewhat to my shock, really, that my professors and the other students, the other graduate students in my program, thought that this was kind of odd, that I read these books by the people who were the patients rather than focusing on the people who were the professionals.
There's kind of an assumption that, well, these are crazy people, so they don't really understand their own experience. They need someone else to explain it.
Exactly. And, of course, I was studying for a PhD in psychology, and so my focus, everyone assumes, should be on what do psychologists say. And, of course, I was interested in that as well, but I retained this interest and perhaps being a bit of a rebel myself, the more that people discouraged me from this interest, the more intense it became. And especially, I couldn't understand why this body of material wasn't treated more seriously by mental health professionals. And it helped that I was not myself training to be a therapist. I'm a professor of psychology, and I teach psychology in a college, but I am not myself a mental health professional. I don't treat people in psychotherapy. I've never sent anyone to a hospital. I've never given them a medication. I don't have anything to do with that kind of work. And even when I was in graduate school, I was not studying to become a therapist. I wasn't learning how to give people psychological tests or any of those kinds of things. So I was a bit freer in what I could focus on, and I was a bit less defensive, I think, than some of my fellow students who were busy identifying with being a future mental health professional and needing to feel like everything professionals did was right. And so I developed this interest, and I learned really not to talk about it that much among fellow professionals, but I continued to collect these books, and over a period of time, when I found that there were hundreds of first-person narratives of madness, I began to compile a bibliography so as to make available the list of titles to other people so that other people could find out about these. Because not only were they so insightful, just from a really a social science perspective, I thought that we had to acknowledge the fact that this is a huge body of material. It just had to be treated seriously because there's so much of it and because it's so varied and it's so diverse. So I began to compile this bibliography, which now I think we can maybe talk more about this. This bibliography, which is now in its fourth edition, has more than 700 titles on it of first-person narratives of madness.
And this is available for people to download and take a look at on your website, gailhornstein.com. Is that right?
Yes, it is. It's available for free download, and many, many people link to this bibliography all over the world, and people are welcome to do that, and there's information about it on the website. But this leads back to Agnes's Jacket. The reason I wrote this book was because after years of reading these first-person narratives myself, it was clear to me that if we thought about psychosis or any of the states that get labeled psychosis or madness from the point of view of people who experience them, we would have a completely different set of assumptions about those experiences than we would if we started from the assumptions that mental health professionals use. So Agnes's Jacket is really the result of having read all those narratives for so many years and thought about what are the implications of thinking about madness from this other point of view.
And you say in your book that from the time that people were writing and publishing books and writing memoirs and writing autobiographies, there's always been people writing about their experiences with going mad, with going crazy, and how they came back and what they went through and how they managed to recover or get themselves back together. That this is a long-standing literature. It's been around from the very beginning of the novel and beginning of autobiography itself.
That's absolutely right. And some of the most interesting narratives on my bibliography are ones that were written, say, in the 15th century, the 16th century, before psychiatry came to exist as a specialized field of medicine. And of course, people writing prior to that time were not diagnosed in any way. There wasn't anyone to diagnose them. There wasn't any categories of mental dysfunction with which they could be diagnosed. For instance, I write about a fascinating book called The Book of Marjorie Kemp, which was written, actually it was dictated because Marjorie Kemp was a woman living in 15th century England, and she was, unfortunately, like many women of the day, illiterate, but she dictated her experiences to two priests who were among the literate people of the day. And her book, which is filled with unusual experiences, she hears voices, she has many, many experiences that today would be labeled psychotic. Her book is considered by scholars of literature to be the first autobiography in English, not just the first madness narrative, but the first autobiography by anyone written in English as opposed to Latin or some non-vernacular language.
And in this literature of people writing about their own madness experiences, there's an enormous diversity. I mean, there are people who talk about going out of their minds and coming back and recovering and talking about their return to sanity. And then there are folks who don't see themselves as crazy or insane, but from the outside, they're very, very unusual experiences. There are folks who talk about deeply spiritual experiences that they went through. They were very positive and life-affirming, and they feel like they grew from. And then other people who talk about it in terms of illness and disease and getting swept up in something that was very destructive and life-threatening, or other kinds of experiences. There's a whole range of kinds of approaches to what madness is. No, there's no single answer to that.
That's absolutely right. And to me, that's the starting point for a radical restructuring of our understanding of these kinds of experiences. Because the whole notion, diagnostic system like the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual that's published by the American Psychiatric Association, or any other classification system. There's another system used in Europe, published by the World Health Organization, called the ICD, International Classification of Diseases. Any of these classification systems make the assumption that you can group people's experiences together into categories like schizophrenia, bipolar illness, dissociative disorder, and so on, and that the so-called symptoms that people have in common for these kinds of so-called disorders erase, essentially, the differences in experience between people. And Agnes's second and my whole approach starts from the opposite assumption, based on reading these first-person accounts, that if you start with people's own experiences, you are overwhelmed at every point with the diversity, the variation, the differences between people's experiences. And I think in and of itself, that should tell us that diagnostic systems like these, like the DSM and other ones that have been proposed, are automatically limited by their oversimplifying and their glossing over, or even sometimes erasing, all of these differences. That the assumption that everyone with the diagnosis of schizophrenia is the same.
And so you get people talking about bipolar disorder is this, or schizophrenia is this, rather than saying, here's what I experienced. This is my experience, and it may have some overlap, it may have some patterns, it may have some things that you share, but you cannot reduce it to a category that's going to group everybody together, because that ends up leading you in a direction of very cookie cutter, one size fits all ways of helping people, which really miss the individuality involved.
I would even go further than that, that not only the individuality, I think you miss an understanding of these experiences themselves. That the assumption that you can classify them in these ways, especially using a system like the DSM, which doesn't include anything at all about the meaning of the experience for the person, I think you are essentially preventing an understanding of what the experience is for the person. I think these diagnostic systems lead us in exactly the wrong direction, because they lead us away from the meaningful aspects of people's experiences. And so then it's no surprise, once you use that kind of a classification, that people would say, well, these experiences don't mean anything. They're just gibberish. People just say nonsense.
And I think that the irony of this is that actually the process of diagnosis and categorizing people can actually become an obstacle to someone getting better and getting an understanding about their experience. I mean, if you think of it just in common sense terms, if you're in trouble or you have a problem, you want to talk about it. You want to have someone understand you so that you can start to make sense of what you need to do to deal with the situation that you're in. And the diagnostic process puts a real stop on that kind of human connection of telling our stories, getting someone to listen to us, explaining what we're going through, getting some sense of understanding, overcoming isolation. And I think this is really one of the things that I love about your work, Gail, is that you've identified this huge gap between what it is that mental patients, people who are identified as having mental disorders, say about our own experiences, and then what professionals say about the experiences of mental patients. And there's this huge gap between the two things. And it's a power difference, really. It's one group, the profession, has the power to define, to silence, to categorize, to ignore, to not listen to what people are saying about their own experiences. And I think this is really the thread that runs through your approach and the approach of the Freedom Center, the approach of the Hearing Voices movement, is to say, look, let's start by connecting with people and saying, what is happening to you? Let's talk with you about what is your experience as you understand it. And let's go through the process of trying to make some kind of connection, even if it seems unusual, strange, bizarre, incomprehensible, confusing, whatever it is. At least the effort of trying to listen and trying to make that connection can itself be a healing process that gets missed, I think, in our medical and pharmaceutical and professional approach in the mental health system today.
Yes, exactly. And before we even can get to the point where someone's experience is being crammed into a diagnostic category and reformulated as pathological, even before that, one of the things that's so painful to me about the many, many first-person accounts of madness that I've read is the extent to which people were simply unheard. The extent to which people who, for instance, were in a locked mental institution, which of course is the is true for the great majority of people who've written accounts of their experience, they were on a locked ward, they were in some kind of a institution where they weren't free to recount what was happening to them. There are so many people that have written accounts, or, you know, today, of course, we have many more kinds of narratives than just written accounts. We have blogs, we have oral histories, we have testimonies, and so on. But especially of the written accounts, so many people say, I'm writing this account now that I finally got out of that institution, and I'm writing it using the scraps of notes that I kept that were hidden under my bed, or in some more desperate cases, written in blood on the wall, or screamed out from a padded cell or an isolation room. I mean, people have gone to extraordinary lengths to be able to keep their own accounts of their experience when they're deprived of writing materials or any way to really tell their story.
So these are very much like slave narratives or like prisoner narratives.
Yes, I think that is completely true. And let me just, you know, give the example. I called the book Agnes's Jacket, and on the cover of the book, and you can see this on the website, there's a photograph of this jacket. Let me just say a word about Agnes. Agnes Richter was a woman who was forcibly institutionalized in a German mental institution in the 1890s. And she was a woman who had lived a pretty successful life. She was trained as a professional seamstress, and she supported herself making clothes. And when she was in her 40s, she was taken to an institution against her will. She fought continuously to escape from this place. Unfortunately, she was never able to escape. She was kept there for the next 26 years until her death. But the reason we know about Agnes Richter today is because she took the uniform that she was forced to wear. I don't know if people know this, but in the 19th century, especially in Europe, mental patients were often forced to wear institutional uniforms, like prisoners. And as best as I can tell from years of trying to piece her story together, Agnes took her uniform and took it apart, because she was a trained seamstress and she knew how to do this. She took it apart and she re-sewed it into a very, very beautiful jacket. And on the surface of this jacket, the entire surface, the inside, the outside, the sleeves, the collar, she embroidered, using thread of six different colors, a narrative of her life. And we can only imagine the extraordinary power of this woman on a locked ward wearing this garment. We know that she wore it. This jacket is now in a museum in Heidelberg, Germany. We can imagine all the women around her were wearing these uniforms that looked like sacks, or they were wearing straitjackets, another kind of jacket. And here she was wearing this absolutely beautiful garment that she had created herself, and on it is emblazoned the story of her life. And I think that the reason she did this was that she didn't have any other way of telling this story. No one would listen to her. I don't know whether she had any writing materials. Women often were deprived of writing materials, but they were, oddly enough, allowed to sew in mental institutions. And she basically wore her story on her body.
It's a really incredible image, and it just speaks to the silencing that happens, that she would have that powerful desire to just get her story written in her own way as sewing it onto her own clothing. Makes me think of all the people who didn't have the strength or the courage that she had, all those voices that were just squashed, all the stories that were lost, all of the experiences that were discounted, and the ways in which people weren't able to hold on to that voice of, this is who I am, this is my narrative, this is my story, this is my life. And so now we have the example of these heroes, really, like Agnes, who were able to carry that story forward and get it out into the light of day as a way of reminding us about the people who didn't and still aren't given the opportunity to be listened to and validated and have their own life story listened to in the way that they want to tell it.
Yes, exactly. And again, as we were saying earlier, what's so important to me is of course, first of all, the human right of everyone to be able to tell their story in their own terms. But also, in the case of these people who've been labeled psychiatric patients, the content of their story, what they're actually saying in their story, contradicts what mental health professionals are saying about them. So it's not, I don't even want to say it's not only, it's of course partly that they have to have the right to provide their own account, but we have to ask the question, why are they not given this right? Why do they have to fight for the opportunity to give their own account? And the reason is clearly because mental health professionals don't want to hear what people have had to say about their own experience, because it contradicts so much of what is taken for granted in psychiatry.
Well, the assumption is that, well, whatever you say about yourself is just a symptom of your broken brain, that obviously you're just talking crazy. And the more we listen to you, the more we're kind of sucked up into your madness. And so we have to sort of be separate and create our own professional interpretation. So, Gail, there's a way in which people talking about their own experience is seen as a symptom of a disorder or a symptom of a brain malfunction, but you're saying that there's actually a way in which what people have to say is threatening to the profession as well.
Yes, and that's especially true when people talk about how their so-called symptoms arose as a consequence of trauma. There are so many people who talk about sexual abuse, racism, other forms of trauma that they experienced, often as children, but maybe even later in their life. I've worked with a lot of groups, for instance, in London, where there are asylum seekers and refugees from all over the world, people who have been in horrifying situations of war and torture and abuse. And after they've gone through those situations and escaped from them, then they have so-called psychiatric symptoms, like they hear voices. They hear the voice of their abuser. They hear the voice of the person who tortured their entire family and shot their father in front of their eyes. And the idea that we should consider these accounts to be gibberish, nonsense, craziness, is not only deeply disrespectful, but it's simply wrong. We have to understand how people come to have unusual and frightening and anguish-ridden experiences as a consequence of things that have happened to them. As Jackie Dillon, one of the most inspiring people that I've worked with, who is an activist in the Hearing Voices Network in London, always says, don't ask what's wrong with you, ask what's happened to you.
And that, I think, brings us to the discussion in your book about the work of the Hearing Voices Network and the Freedom Center, which I co-founded in Western Massachusetts, which is really based around support groups that are all about giving people an opportunity to talk in their own words, free of professional censorship or professional control.
The reason I subtitled the book A Psychologist's Search for the Meanings of Madness is because I wanted to tell a little bit of my own story of coming to have a different understanding of these phenomena of psychosis, madness, whatever we want to call it. And I wanted to include some of my own story, both because I was talking about people's stories and I don't want to talk about other people's stories without making clear that, you know, I have my own subjective experience. But also, it gave me the opportunity to really take readers through the kinds of amazing moments that I myself felt when I discovered groups like the Hearing Voices Network and Freedom Center. And actually, let me just talk a little bit about that, because it was so revolutionary to me. I was working on these first-person narratives in England 5 years ago, and I was talking to a lot of different people in a lot of different groups, and someone said to me, you know, you should come to this conference that we're having. The conference was called Beyond Belief, which was a perfect title for it. And it was the first conference I'd ever gone to where most of the people that were giving presentations at the conference, which was held in a very posh place at the University of London, most of the people who were giving presentations were people who themselves heard voices. And this conference was sponsored by the Hearing Voices Network, something that I'd never heard of before. This was in 2003. And that day really completely changed my life, because I met all these people who were involved in the creation of an alternative to standard mental health practice about this experience that psychiatrists call auditory hallucinations, a word which, of course, makes clear that it's being pathologized and seen as a problem. And these people were talking about hearing voices, which is a much more neutral way of talking about it. And they recounted their experiences in these support groups that they had created outside the mental health system that were having powerful, powerful, positive effects on people's lives. People who had been in the mental health system for 20 years, 30 years, had had every medication, had had ECT, shock treatment, had had every kind of approach that had been invented, and they still were suffering, and they were going to these support groups and transforming their experience. And through Jackie Dillon, who is now the chair of the Hearing Voices Network in England, and a number of other people that I met then, I came into contact with these groups, and for several years, I sat in on them in London and in other places in the UK, and learned this completely different approach that had been developed by almost entirely by people who had diagnoses of schizophrenia themselves. And that, when I came back to the U.S., that then led me to find Freedom Center and other groups like it that were doing the same kind of thing in the U.S. And I say in the book, and I believe this so deeply, that Freedom Center and the Hearing Voices Network are leading us to a radical reconception of what madness is, how people can cope with experiences that are very difficult, and how they can completely recover from difficult situations that mental health professionals often have told them they will suffer with for the rest of their lives.
And that is where we have to leave this interview due to time. If you'd like to hear the rest of it, the whole interview is downloadable from our webpage at unwelcomeguests.net/620. All previous episodes of the show are available for download from our MP3 archive at unwelcomeguests.net/archive. There's a Twitter feed announcing new episodes at twitter.com/unwelcomeguests. And if you have comments about this episode, you can start or join a discussion about it from the discussion tab of this show's webpage. Our theme music is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thanks for listening.